Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Nicole. And if you enjoy this show, you will love our podcast, Self Care Club.
Every week, we trial a different form of self-care and report back on the results.
We've tried everything from cuddle therapy, setting boundaries, laughter yoga, and many more.
Two friends
who rarely agree on anything,
testing out the world of self-care so you don't have to.
We've even written a book dedicated to self-care practices that cost you nothing.
You can listen to Self Care Club wherever you get your podcasts.
Or to purchase our book, search Have You Tried This on Amazon.
Everything was completely distorted in one sense, you know, but the conflict was here.
Yeah.
My gut. I never trusted my gut. I just listened to my head. Right? So there would be that constant battle. You know, well, I want. And plus, and coupled with all that, I was compulsive. Compulsion of everything. As a child, sugar. Moved on from sugar to nicotine. I was 7 years of age, cigarette, walking down the road, trying to be something I'm not. Trying to grow up before my time.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefull. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest today is Jim, or Jimmy as I call him. He has 45 years sobriety and he is a stoic backbone of recovery in London. Jim talks about why surrender is not losing, but how letting go is the secret key to success. Smoking at the age of 7, incarceration from the age of 16, and getting sober in prison, and the Peter Pan syndrome. Jimmy tells us how recovery is available to everyone for free, once you're finally ready to see, hear, and experience it. I hope this conversation shows you how to boldly go where you may have feared to go before, and why accepting love into your life over fear can be so much more exciting than living in this fantastical world of make-believe. Jim, thank you so much for coming. This is powerful. I really appreciate it. I know you have very good sobriety. How many years sobriety do you have?
I'm actually 45. Of continuous sobriety.
Yeah, which is an important thing to say.
Continuous.
Yeah, which is incredible, mate. That's really amazing. I hope I get there, by the way.
Hope so.
Your inspiration. I'd love to ask you where you're from and how was your upbringing?
Well, I grew up in a small village just outside Glasgow. It was a mining community, the local mine, and it was, you know, there was the coal board scheme, you know. My mother grew up on a miner's row in Brig End as a young child.
Is a miner's row literally like the row of houses?
A row of houses, they call it the miner's row.
Yeah.
One bedroom, you know, it housed, you know, a multitude of children. But my mother grew up, there were 3 children in her household. You know, my grandfather was a miner. My uncle was a miner. My 2 grandfathers worked in the pit. You know, and my uncle worked in the pit. And at the age of 4, they had a disaster. They had a pit disaster where a lot of people lost their lives. So that was in 59, that disaster.
Yeah.
I was 4 years old. I was just, you know, but the ambulances, fire brigades, sirens. And as a child, seeing all these trucks and lights, I was all excited. And I was watching all these adults running out with their coats to get down to the pit because the siren went off. There was a disaster. So it closed down after that. But that was one of my early memories of my childhood, you know.
Yeah.
And I was always I was a wanderer as a child. You know, I used to take myself off, you know, and there'd be search parties. Where's he going? I'd jump on a bus without any intention and where it was going.
Wow.
And get off and, you know, and go to see my mother's friends and back and knock the door. I'll just come to see you. How are you doing? Yeah. So right off the back. So basically I was kind of a nightmare to my mother. I was the youngest.
Yeah.
And it was like always, you know, I call myself Jimmy or Jim, you know, but the family call me James, which is my birth name.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like when I'm called James, it's like I'm in trouble.
Gotcha.
Because I was always in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, and that was part of my makeup. Everything I did was normal to me, but unacceptable to others. As a child, my father would take us in walks, you know, and describe what it was like living in that environment, you know, where it was it was poor.
Yeah.
You know, what you get paid then, my grandparents get paid in tokens, and they had to spend it in the shop.
No way.
Yeah, and
wow.
You know, so that was the control of the cobalt back in the day when it was private, when it was a privately owned before it became a government owned.
So you could literally only spend that on food.
Food and
they probably owned a supermarket as well.
Yeah, well they had their own shops, and that's where you did the shopping with the tokens that they paid you with. So my grandfather was quite renowned for, you know, going out snaring rabbits for more food. You know, I remember killing a rabbit on a snare as a young boy, and I was horrified.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, because I felt, you know, that deep feeling of, you know, I shouldn't have done this.
Mm.
But I did. A friend skinned it and my mother ate it. You know, so it was things like that. But we were always told about the hardship of the mine. Of being in the community. So the options as a child, you know, it was either, there were three things. You either go down the pit, join the armed forces, or work in the construction. So they were the kind of options growing up within.
What, did you feel that as a suppression, or was that just it?
Well, Paul, it was like, I was the youngest of seven siblings, right? And Scotland kind of boasts about their education system, especially the Catholic. Going to Catholic school, very disciplined and very pushy. You know, so the opportunity was there. The only problem was I was there.
Right, okay.
Right, so, and I had this, I was preoccupied. I didn't know why I was preoccupied, but I was never in the moment. I was always looking behind me, and what happened a few weeks ago, or projecting into the future, but never stayed in the day.
Mm.
So I had I think they call it attention deficit.
Yeah.
Right? So there's labels today describing my behaviour. Back then, they described it as a juvenile delinquent.
Yeah, for many years that was the best,
right? Years. So, and it was like, because of my disposition as a child and not knowing. Right, it was like of what was going on within me and round about me. Nobody identified it. They just, you know, a troublesome child. You know, they compared me with my siblings. Why can't you be like? And I can't be like because I'm not them.
Yeah, which doesn't help when you're a child.
No, it doesn't, because it just emphasizes of not being enough. So it was always that not enough, not good enough, not smart enough. My oldest sibling, she was a high achiever. She was the oldest, and her energy went into succeeding. So she became a laboratory technician. She was quite high up in the cancer field, where she actually lectured and things like that. So she did high achieve, right? And it's like, what an order, I can't go through with it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm at the other end of the spectrum. You know, so I've got six people to, you know, compete with for that accolade of affection. So I went to the other extreme for the notice, where it was bad behaviour. I didn't know at the time, but that was me getting my needs met.
Yeah.
So I was a clown. You know, so when people were being serious, I was being a fool. And when I tried to be serious, they were being a fool. So I just didn't seem to get it right. You know, it was like just one step forward, 10, but, you know, that uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
So where I went, you know, it's the system I went through, the schooling system as a small child, they turned out doctors, lawyers, politicians, you know, so it wasn't a lack of. The opportunity was there, but my illness was there and I was not conscious of it.
When we talk about illness, because we know, what does that mean? The illness was there.
Well, the illness of alcoholism, as I see it today, as I know it today, the alcoholism is within the person.
Yeah.
Where alcohol is in a bottle, two different things. I didn't drink myself into alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic who drank. I used alcohol to change, to anaesthetize. As I was sharing now, you know, I was suicidal by 12. Wow. 12 years of age, and I'm thinking, dying. Life's not worth living. You know, so it was like going through that process of not enough. So there was that empty void. You know, there was, and it'd be in there, and it would be, I didn't feel comfortable in my core.
Yeah.
And when, you know, and people say, you know, when I took things to my parents, they would say, you're imagining it. It's all in your mind. And it was all in my mind, because that's where my illness dwells.
But you're not being heard again, are you, when you
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, they didn't know. You know, they didn't know. It was like, even the education system, they didn't recognise, you know, the problem. I was a problem, you know. But they put it, because they compared me with my family origin, it was, they would shake their head.
The sad thing is there's two polarities here, because you're being viewed as a naughty guy. And then... And the other end, you have the empathy with the rabbit. So you have big feelings and understanding, but it's just completely not being seen, is it?
Well, it's like growing up, I was educated in Catholicism, right? And as a child, you know, I was drawn to the stories of the scriptures in the Bible, and you know, and it fired me up because I couldn't read. You know, I couldn't read. But when they would be reading the stories from the Bible, I get right into it. I was really engrossed in it, you know, of the miracles and things that Jesus Christ was doing as a small child. But what I came up against with having that belief and that faith and that hope, I came up against hypocrisy, right? So hypocrisy... And bigotry, as I said, there was a good education, but there was another side of the education which was toxic, right? And it's like you couldn't question it as a child because you've got to do as your elders tell you.
Yeah.
Well, I had conflict with what elders were saying. You know, my inside, I was having conflict, and I couldn't voice it because I didn't have a voice. So it's having that of not being able, everything was completely distorted in one sense, you know, but the conflict was here.
Yeah.
My gut. I never trusted my gut. I just listened to my head, right? So there would be that constant battle, you know, well, I want. And plus, and coupled with all that, I was compulsive. Compulsion of everything as a child, sugar. Right, moved on from sugar to nicotine. I was 7 years of age, cigarette, walking down the road, trying to be something I'm not, trying to grow up before my time, before the disaster. The old miners used to sit at the top on the dike, at the top of the pit brae, before they went, right? And they'd all be in their pipes, and I would be have a clay pipe, and I'd go, God, give us a fill.
Really?
You know, so there are these guys, you know, probably at my age now, but it was like they were all sitting there puffing their pipes and, you know, and I had my little white clay pipe and they'd point, go and pick the dog ends up. So I'd put the dog ends in and they'd give me a lighter, you know, and going green, you know, and they found it amusing. But I started smoking at 7 and that was progressive. Where once, and it was then, it was at like a caps and full strength.
Yeah.
Free talks and you get dizzy and put it out and light it. And that would last me a week, one cigarette. And then when I got to 15, there was 5 cigarettes. And then that progressed. And then by the time I gave up, it was five pouches of 50 gram tobacco plus cigarettes a week.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Heavy smoking.
Yeah.
So with that comes ill health. I haven't smoked in 23 years. But 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with emphysema, OCPD, lung problem.
Yeah.
My doing.
Yeah.
You know, the sugar addiction, I've got diabetes. My doing. Bad diet. Think I'm invincible.
Yeah.
So that's my mental, that's a twist of being compulsive, doing things that I can't stop myself from doing. Not conscious of it.
When you was 12 and you had suicidal thoughts, how did that manifest itself and did anything happen?
Well things happened, right? Sexual assault happened early, which was, I thought, it was nothing. And then comes the shame, basically, for the shame yet after it.
Yeah.
So there were the feelings of shame. So I stole guilt, fear. I was riddled with fear. I didn't know I was riddled with fear. I didn't know. My mother would say, "Does your conscience not bother you?" And I go, "No." But it did bother me. Because I was not conscious of it bothering me.
Yeah.
Because it was, wait till your father comes home. When I'd done something, and I did it regularly. And it was always, wait till your father came home. My father never lifted his hand to me once. I remember he was supposed to punish me. And he slapped a chair. He says, "I know you're good at making tears. So you make out that you're crying and run up the stairs and stay there for a wee while before you come back down, make your eyes all red." And I went, "Oh, bang, bang, bang." So I did. So he knew me. So, but he never hit me. Probably because he could identify with me as a child, because he also was an alcoholic. So there was that, that abuse was outside of him. There was no abuse apart from the mental and emotional abuse. And realised there was, between me and my mother, I was a mummy's boy, but she kind of rejected, I felt rejection from her.
Yeah.
And I picked that up very early on, and I didn't know, it wasn't until I spoke to my sisters later on, when I'm in recovery, because through going in and looking at myself and the family dynamics, my mother was 40 when she gave birth to me.
Wow, that was late, especially for them as well.
And, that's a young, one boy was still dead, so there was eight children. But I also learned my mother had lots of miscarriages. I learned from an older sibling, and when we were talking about, my mother was pregnant more times than enough because she had quite a lot of miscarriages. Catholic, breed.
Yeah.
So we were a small family of seven. But there were other families with 23, 22, in our community.
Yeah.
So we were relevantly small as a seven, and my auntie had seven. So it was the seven.
You were modest in that way.
So it was like growing up with all this environment and information and misinformation. But I had that feeling of, and I remember, curl up next to her and, I said, "Do you not love me? Don't be silly." When I'd be up and I'd be soaking up to her, she'd say, "What do you want?
Yeah.
What do you want? What do you want?" And all I wanted was to love me, really. Right? But she felt guilty of her feelings. It's only in hindsight, she'd passed by, and only in hindsight that I could connect with me and my mother. Through that depth of, getting in and looking. And where I found my mother was in a book called Women Who Love Too Much.
Wow.
Right? So when I read that book, I seen my mother. And she was a caretaker. She would, my cousins would be rolling down the road drunk, being at the local pub, and she'd herd them in and fill them with coffee before she sent them out.
Yeah.
So it was like, and I was always looking for that same compassion from my mother.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I've no doubt that she did love me. but she felt guilty for how she felt when she was having me. She just gave birth to my brother 11 months previous. Yeah, so I can understand. You know,
close.
Just one pop out and here's another one in.
Yeah.
So I can understand of what she went through and her anxiety and her pain. That, you know, she didn't want any more kids, but
yeah.
Here was that pop out. So with that, because I remember saying to a friend of mine who was saying about his youngest boy, he didn't want another child.
Mm.
I said, don't put that on him. He'll pick that up, how you're feeling.
Yeah.
You know, because I picked it up. I picked that up in the womb. I believe it was in the womb. Before I came out, I could feel her anxiety.
There's science that proves that now. That
right.
You can,
so
you, can,
well,
yeah.
You know, so, and once I came to terms with that, then it was like, I became closer to,
yeah,
you know, of being a, you know, when I turned 40 and I realized my mother gave birth to me at this age, you know, it was just another moment of consciousness.
And it's amazing to do that though, because a lot of people go through life that would resent the situation, but you've looked at it and understood it by standing in her shoes or having the empathy to do that.
Yeah. But like, I got all that through opening the door, right? And it's like, oh, and the door was opened through using the keys.
Yeah.
It's a combination lock. I call it a combination lock. It's the 12 steps, 12 traditions. That opened my door. You know, from childhood, you know, where I ended up before I got to a 12-step program, I was in prison. I was incarcerated. Right, through my behaviour, you know.
What age was that, Jim?
Well, at my first incarceration, I was 16. I was put in a place called Longrigg End. And it was very, I was sharing about it. It was very, very rigid, you know, where you had to sit on a seat or on your bed and not move. And if they seen you loitering or doing it, they'd bust the door in and batter you. So they were quite physically...
Just through the day, you had to sit there.
Yeah, you had to sit there through the day. You weren't allowed to go in bed till the lights were out.
Yeah.
And that was on remand. That wasn't on the conviction. That was just remanded in custody. I was 16. And I was right, and I cried. You know, I missed my mum. Yeah, I missed her cooking. You know, what I couldn't get away quick enough. But once I realised where I was and what I was getting, and the food... I could taste in the food, right? The stuff, the diet is just to sustain you in an institution.
Yeah.
People look at a menu in a prison and it's not, it tastes the same as shit. It's just to sustain you in life that you don't starve to death.
Yeah.
You know, so that was that realization of that progression. So being remanded from a 16-year-old where I stabbed my best friend.
Was this through drinking and stuff?
Yeah, fear. Fear drove it, because he was taller than me. Yeah, I was a little short, you know, 4 foot, nothing. 11, you know, growing up, and he was 5'8", 5'9", so that height barrier, you know, and I was fearful, so it was like, I picked out a kitchen knife and I stabbed him. And I went to stab him again, but other friends moved in, so, and I had, that was a compulsive reaction.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't drunk. I'd been drinking, but I wasn't drunk. But I couldn't stop myself. That rage, that fear, that driving force. But it talks about angry enough to kill.
Yeah.
You know, I did that, and I couldn't stop myself from doing it. It's my best friend. And I did that.
Yeah.
You know, so it was from there, you know, my behaviour, it seemed to get worse. I ran about in a gang as a young boy. You know, there were gangs, you know, they still have them today. You know, but then it was, you know, we had the larger boys and the younger boys, so and a gang.
Yeah.
I would hang out with the big boys, right, and we'd be going to dances. And just halfway through the dance, they'd say to me, see that guy there? Go and stick the nut on him. So I'd get into the dance, jump up, headbutt the guy. And then it'd kick off, and I'd move to the side with the girls. So that, you know, I was their trigger.
Yeah.
You know.
And was that the same feeling of trying to belong? Because I remember that when I was younger too.
Yeah, well, being part of, you know, wanting to be accepted. It's all based on been loved, accepted. You know, that's the gang culture, you know, absent. By that age, my father had passed. When I was 10, my father passed.
Right.
You know, and he was absent most of the time. I have fond memories of him, right? But he used to take us on walks, right? As children, me and my two brothers. And we'd walk round and we end up in a pub. Pub's closed on a Sunday. So this was the Sunday walk my father would take us on, right? And he'd take us right to this pub that he knew, because he worked in the pub business. So he chapped the door. He went in, brought out the lemonade and crisps for me and my two brothers, and, you know, and we're sitting there. Then he'd say, don't tell your mother. Don't tell your mother, right?
Which you wouldn't, because you've already done the tapping of the chair and the tear thing. So there's loyalty there, isn't there?
No, it wasn't. I was open.
Yeah.
When I asked, I told them, right? So when we get back, my mother said, oh, how was it? Oh, we went here, we went there, and my daddy bought us lemonade when he went in the pub. Oh, next thing there's an uproar, right? So I hear the screaming and shouting. It's like, geez, and my brothers are looking at me because I was at home, you know. There was no secret hidden. You know, I just went, blah, 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 blah. You know, so it was like, oh, and they knew if, you know, I would just open up and say everything, because I'd walk into a room and they'd be talking. And then it'd go silent. The room would go silent, right? And then it was like, and it changed. And my mother was, hey, go and do that, send me out. And then I'd go out, and then I'd be listening at the door, and they'd start up the conversation again. So it was like, but every time I walked in, it went silent. So, and that in itself, are they talking about me?
Yeah.
Because it was all about self-centered, all about me, and I thought, and I'm trying to listen, and I can't hear them probably through the door, right? So, and then it's like, we know yet, my mother, I thought she dies, but she was psychic, because she knew I was standing behind the door trying to listen. Get away from that door, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, it was interesting times, frightening times, you know. I lived in a world of make-believe. I moved into fantasy land. They call it the Peter Pan syndrome.
Do you want to describe that, what that means?
Well, the Peter Pan is, I lived in fantasy. I would go out and I would go in down the woods or down the car, and I'd be living in this world of cowboys and Indians, you know, pirates, you know, and things like that. I lived in that world of make-believe. You know, I was a lone child. Although I came right, and I had some friends, but I spent most of my childhood on my own. I wandered. You know, I was happier with myself than with others. Because when I was with others, I felt uncomfortable. I felt inadequate. You know, I don't like football. You know, and people say, oh, it's Scottish and don't like football. Because when I played football as a child, right, there were so good footballers, right? But they were prima donnas. And they go far in the football world, you know. So when you took the ball off them, and then the next minute they're lying in the ground screaming that you fouled them, when you had, you'd actually got the ball off them legally, officially, and then they're down there making a fuss, right? I would go up and kick them in the head. I'll give you something to roll about for, right? Because I knew I hadn't done it, so I'll give you something for doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they stopped picking me to play football, because that's how I reacted. If I took the ball off you, or if you go on the ground making out, I'll give you something.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the...
Because again, it's unjust against you, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't play the game, really.
Yeah.
I didn't join in the game. I wasn't a team player. I tried to be, but I couldn't succeed as a team player.
As well. So there's a disconnect there, isn't there? Because a lot of people that I know that have come into recovery and work a program and do this stuff are probably the most honest people I know, literally. And there's this, and so there's like a disconnect there as well, isn't there?
Well, there's two extremes. You're either brutally or completely, you know. I used to make some fantastic lies and fantasy. You know, you couldn't believe them, you know, and it was like, but I believed them. That was the difference. I believed my own lies. You know, I told that I was kidnapped. You know, we were going, me and my pal, was going to run away from home. Right, so we got to the, up to Coat Bridge. You know, it's about 5 miles away. Right, so we got up there and we did a bit of shoplifting and Woolworths. Yeah, right, and then as at night was coming, hunger struck. You know, no money. I think I must have been about 12, 13. Right, and apparently they were all out looking for us, me and this fella. So we managed to get ourselves home. You know, it was about 11 o'clock. We ended up back in the local village. Right, and where have you? We made up this story that we were kidnapped and locked in a warehouse, but we escaped. Yeah, totally bizarre.
Yeah,
just get to bed. You know, but I believed that lie. Yeah. I convinced myself.
You should have been a movie director. Right? Because there's a lot of really good movie directors and writers that lived in that world and transferred that skill into movies.
So it was like that, you know. But there was always consequences, right? Wait till your father comes home.
Mm.
So that impending doom, wait, and that's all she needed to say. My mother was a disciplinarian. You know, she wasn't short of lashing out and giving you a slap, you know, which I provoked. Most of the time, you know, and it was like from that, it was just that the worst part was the mental. Wait till your father, he never came home. And when he did come home, I was in my bed, you know, and I'd be restless, irritable. Right? Then I'd be late for school because, I couldn't sleep. I was too tired. So being late for school. So they call it insomnia. I call it a guilty conscience.
Yeah.
That's why I couldn't sleep. My conscience was bothering me, but I didn't know that. But it was having that impending doom.
When did alcohol come into the mix in your early years?
It came very early, right? Because, as I said, my father worked in a pub and we'd go and see him in his workplace.
This is after the mine shut, right?
Yeah. So it became public. It was salesman public, and, you know, so it was like... His pit life was very short-lived, you know, so it was like, it was more into working in bars, you know, then when they managed bars, they weren't like here where they lived in the pub, came with the, you know, the home came with the job, where there was no residence in the Scottish pubs, unless it was a hotel.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, so he managed a lot of pubs, since he was the manager. You know, and we'd go to the pub and, you know, we'd get Coca-Cola and I would be drinking the slops from round the glasses. I'm going to help pick up these glasses. And I was like, you know, so it was there.
Yeah.
And I remember my mother actually finding a stash of my father's, a half bottle of whiskey, and she was pouring it down the sink. And I went, oh, that's a waste, Mum. Why don't you just keep that and you might use it later? Because I knew I wanted it.
Yeah.
Even at that age, I was trying to get it.
Was it not? Did you see any of it as a problem?
No.
No.
I was drawn to it.
Yeah.
I was attracted. It was calling me, right? And it was like shandies, you know. And what I realized was not having alcohol, having it. It was secure. I didn't have to drink it as long as I knew it was there.
Mm.
I remember at New Year. My brother, who's 11 months older, get blotto, you know, I got him home. He was down in Moodysburn, which is near Brig End, and we had to come up the Pit Brae, and I'm near enough carrying him. I've got my alcohol in a bag, but I'm fairly sober, and I propped him up at the door and rang the bell and stood at the side, and then when the door was open, I fell in and I dragged him in. And then I buggered off for 3 days.
Yeah.
Right? So it was having it. As long as it was there, I was secure because it was my Lionel's blanket.
Did it change the way you feel when you first had a drink?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't like the taste. I loved the effect because it hit that spot which anaesthetized.
Mm.
Then came the change. Then, as it said, the trigger. It was triggered. You know, in the beginning, it was like weekends. underage. I was an underage drinker. I drank in public parks, public toilets, you know, behind shops, you know, because it was illegal. We were only 14, 15, and we'd chip in for a carry out and things like that. It was a ritual on a Friday night, is you know,
yeah.
Which we do in the group, you know, and it was like, and I remember what, you know, it took forever to people put money in, because mine's went straight in, mine's no hesitation, there's mine, let's go and get it. But it was like, and that period was frustrating,
yeah.
Because they were all humming and not putting in, and we were short, and the guys holding back, you know, and it's like right near enough to the element, this shop's going to close in a minute, you know, and then they put it in and then we get, you know, but that was a major irritation of, you know, anticipating, is it going to happen, is that going to happen, you know, so it was that, and that's 14, 15.
Yeah.
You know, so it was that anxiety, are you going to get it, you're not going to get it, so, but, and then getting it, only once did we got it in record time, because these girls got off the bus and says, if you get us drunk, you can do anything you want. They were flinging money.
They were flinging double money. Amounts.
Yeah. So the power of sex, you know, so it was far greater. Your minds was more drink rather than that. Yeah. So that was their priority, you know, for flinging their money in. So, you know, I had a relatively, I was happy-go-lucky. But then still, I had moments of despair. I remember my mother would say things like, you'll be the death of me. You'll be the death of me. I should have scuttled you at birth. Yeah, that's where I had pushed her to that point that they would. And that was cutting. But it also endorsed what I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then at the age of 17, she died.
Oh, wow.
And they words were coming, you'll be the death of me. And I took that on board.
Wow.
And people voiced it as well. Your behaviour, you know, it drove your mother to having a heart attack.
Wow, that's heavy.
You know, heavy shit, yeah. Right? And I reacted to that shit. You know, and I got arrested, and the local police brought my sister in, and, you know, and I was verbally abusive to her. Oh, fuck. You know, so it's like, I was verbally abusive by that time, you know. And then after my mother was buried, you know, the sister that came to see her, I was verbally abusive to, you know, who started, she was only 25. You know, she's just a young woman. You're trying to hold things together, you know, the home. And it was like, but her, what she wanted from me and what I used to give my mother were two different things. Because when I gave my mother my pay packet unopened, she'd give me pocket money and buy all my clothes. But my sister wanted to, you know, get all my money, give me my pocket money, and I'll buy all my own clothes. And I went, no.
Yeah, different deal.
Different deal. I'm not doing it. So I get outed. I ended up sleeping in a tent for a few weeks. And fortunate for me, it was in the July, you know, and then I came down south on holiday. And I've been here ever since.
It's a long holiday, Jimmy.
Long holiday. Still a holiday. You know? But it was like that was my first geographical change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that, did you just say, sod this, I'm going down to London because the streets are paved with gold?
I went to Solent. I went to Portsmouth.
Oh, okay.
Because I had
you went really south.
My sister lived in Portsmouth. And I went to live with her for a short period of time. And I was coming up for my 18th birthday. And she worked in the Citizen Advice Bureau. My sister's paraplegic. Right? She had something in her spine that she lost the ability to walk. She was young. She was about 28 when that happened.
Wow.
You know, so I went to stay with her. Right? But she did voluntary work in the local community in Portsmouth. But even she suggested to me when I was, you know, why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous? And I went, I say, I'm not that bad. Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous from Days and Wine and Roses. I remember my mother watching it and she was in tears.
That's such a good play.
Right? So so she was in tears. So I knew there was something that touched her, you know, because that was all about alcoholism. Yeah, so my sister suggested, and said, now get a second job. So I ended up doing two jobs. Still get drunk. Yeah, so she you know, my mother at 15 mentioned it, right? My sister at 18. Right? I got to my first door of AA when I was 19.
So young still.
I was 19. And the only reason I was there was because my friend was in there. He was 27. And it was a drinking buddy. And I get stopped at the door. It was a closed meeting back then. And this guy asked me two questions. The first question he asked me, he said, are you an alcoholic? And I went, I don't know. The second question he asked me, he said, do you want to stop drinking? And I went, no, not really. And he said, well, I'm sorry, we can't help you. And then as I walked away, what I heard was, fuck off and don't waste my time.
Yeah.
You know, and I called them all the Irish bees under the sun, thick night, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But what he did for me, I believe, saved me. That man saved me. That man was not conscious of him saving me. Because when I met him later and I talked about that, he couldn't remember.
It's funny how some people impact you personally, but for them
It's nothing. It was nothing, right? Mm. But it was profound impact.
What was it then, Jimmy, from going to that guy and basically being rejected to going back to the 12-step program? How did that happen?
Well, my makeup, I'm a people pleaser. I will please you. If I had come in then at 19, I'd have danced the dance, but with no substance.
Yeah.
Right, and then I would have been probably slipping, right? And with my pride, which I'm very prideful, I wouldn't have come back.
Yeah,
you know, so that would have condemned me to death, an early grave. Right, so from that point to actually me getting to my first meeting, there was a 6-year period. Right, and that 6 years, I did all the things. I get progressively worse. So when I came and stayed, what I heard was I heard I have an illness and not a weakness.
Yeah.
I heard it comes in, my illness comes in people. What I deal with my illness comes in a bottle or a powder or a substance, but mainly a bottle. And they said, if you have any doubt about your alcoholism, go and try some social drinking. I had no doubt at that point.
Yeah.
I had done it all. So I thought slipping was a requirement for membership because I heard all these people slipping. I had done my slipping from that 19 to 25.
I think that's really beautiful what you said and very, very clear. And I think that's why sometimes places like 12 Steps get a bad rap, because people do pop in and pop out and pop in and pop out. Mm. And that's not really the stats, because as far as I'm concerned, people I know that work and live a 12-step program don't relapse and don't go out there. That's my experience.
Mm.
When they said to you it was an illness, did you understand what that meant?
I didn't really fully understand what they talked about, because I thought it was a weakness, right? And I was not weak. So my concept was alcoholics were weak. And when I got that concept was watching television, Westerns. You know, the town drunk, he was weak, cowardly.
Yeah.
I was not one of them. So that was my concept. When people talk about being park bench drinkers, I started out drinking outside in park benches and parks and fields and behind shops. So coming to the realization that I have this illness, and where I discovered that was through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was, you know, so, and I'm glad I had a great deal of outside interference.
Yeah.
Because I was isolated. I was incarcerated. I get sober in prison.
Oh, okay.
Right? My first meeting was in Wandsworth.
Oh, wow.
Right? And it's like, and I got the book after the second meeting and I went through. I had a reading problem. I learned to read in prison through pornographic literature because it was the only thing that held my attention.
Yeah.
But when I read that book, you know. And there was there's words in it which were not in my vocabulary, you know, for an animal of Crave. I didn't even know what that meant. But what I did read from that doctor's opinion was, he can't help me. Doctors can't help me. But what he prescribed, these people can. And I had a trust issue with people, because I had trust issues with myself. But I went through the book, and that jumped out at me. Right? Doctor can't help me. These people can. I used to have that part in my mind, I think I'm mad. I never went for a second opinion in case they confirmed it.
Yeah.
Because I thought madness was like the one flew over the cuckoo's nest, shuffled, you know, straitjackets and all that. But the madness is the quiet whisper. No, like the, and when I read The Jaywalker,
yeah,
I remember reading that. And they go, what would you call this chap? I went, he's fucking mad. And then they said, and what was your drinking like? Then the penny dropped for me. It's not, it's a bit doing the same thing over and over and over, and it get progressively worse, worse and worse.
Yeah.
And it talked about, you know, a profound shift. And I had that. I had a profound shift. I was touched by a spirit, which I had been grown up, and I would call it the Holy Ghost. It was a very profound, lit up my cell and changed my life. And from that point to this point, I haven't drank.
Was you on your own in your cell?
I was on my own when I did that third step.
Yeah, which is a profound experience.
It was overwhelming. And people said, well, why do you think? Because I was stubborn. I was belligerently stubborn. And I needed that shock, and I needed to be in that environment for that to happen to me. And I remember it talks about an understanding person. So I get the priest up. You know, I went and said, I see the priest. So the priest came up to my cell, dubbed the door so that he couldn't get locked in with me, got me to sit at the end of the bed, and he's by the door. And all I could say, a miracle, a miracle, a miracle. I was a bit hysterical because it was profound.
Yeah.
And I had to tell it someday, an understanding person. I thought, he'll understand. And I'm going, a miracle, it was here last night, Jay. And he's going, calm down, calm down, calm down. And he goes, he gets his hands, and he twists it like this. He goes, a miracle is a deformity straightened out. I went, that's me.
Wow.
That's me. Because
so there's a confirmation then.
That was but he hadn't experienced God.
Mm.
That was what I found out. He hadn't experienced, he hadn't been touched by God. I had. So no, you know, because it's as you. I had no understanding, but here I got that understanding. It was profound. So I could no longer deny it. Right? I found it early in my work. I couldn't talk about it because people would give me funny looks.
Yeah.
When I tried to explain what had happened to me, they'd go like, oh, yeah. And it was back closed down. I'd closed down. Now I won't close it. I'll open it up. I'll share it freely. You know, I'll shout it from the rooftops. Because it's done for me what I couldn't do for myself. And the miracle of change, when I talked about miracles, right? And it's like on that point, it's, as it takes me back to my childhood, where it talked about the blind could see, the dumb could speak, and the deaf could hear. I was all three. I was deaf, I was dumb, I was blind. Then I started to hear things, see things, and say things. Where did that come out of my mouth? Yeah. So people, they may see the number 12 bus passing, but they can't see what's in it.
Yeah.
It's a wee bit like the program. People see, get there, but they can't see it. So I got the sight. I seen it. It was there. That was profound.
You have to understand, people have to have a powerful shift and a sensation and a mind shift to understand what you're talking about.
Right? Do you know that song with Hot Chocolate, I Believe in Miracles?
Yep.
Well, I never heard the word miracle. I heard my cause.
Right.
Right? You know, and this song had been out 30-odd years, and I was driving with an operative in the city, right? And he was my operative, and that come on the radio, and I start singing along with the song. I can't sing, you know, I just sing along. And I'm going, I believe in my cause, where are you from, you sexy thing? And he looked at me and said, what are you singing? What are you singing? I said, I'm singing along. He says, that's not the lyrics. That's not the lyrics, but that's what I hear.
Yeah.
And it's not the lyrics. He Googled it, he got the words up and showed me. I still hear it.
Jimmy, for someone who's 45 years sober, what practices have you found in that period of time that keep you strong and keep you desiring to work in a 12-step program and stay sober?
You know that Star Trek, you know the opening gambit to Star Trek? Well, I was a Trekkie, right? And it says in the opening gambit, boldly go where no one's gone before.
Yeah.
Inner space. I took drugs to get out of space, out of my mind. You know, what I did with the 12 steps was to go inside, inner space. You know, so I went in, and I went into the realm of the magic, the Peter Pan, where I was lost. I lost myself in that. And then I went in and brought myself out of that.
Wow.
So it's about working. Boldly go where no one's gone before.
Inside.
Faced my fears.
Yeah.
And looked at all the things that I was misread. People told me, good for nothing, you won't amount to anything. And things like that. And as you know, I do carvings on sticks. And there's some I do three faces. And they three faces that I call them, you know, love is one face. The second face is success. And the third one is wealth. Right? But, you know, if you just take the wealth, you'll only have wealth. If you just take success, you'll only have success. But if you take love into your life, you will be granted success and wealth.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what's kept me going. And I thought wealth was having a big house, fast car. Wealth is not nothing to do with that. You know, so I'm wealthy because I'm healthy. You know, and it's successful. I haven't drank. To me, that's successful. And the reason I'm successful is because I've got love in my life. And love is God.
Yeah.
God is nothing more, nothing else, nothing like pure, purity, pure love. Hate and love do not dwell in the same house. So that's why I know I'm not God. Yeah, and that's what keeps me going.
That's really beautiful, Jim. For those who are listening to the podcast, not watching on YouTube, your eyes are blue and they're glowing. Is if someone's listening and they are potentially going down the road of alcoholism or drug addiction, or they are already there, what advice would you give them?
You surrender to win. So I read that in the book, and I thought, how can you surrender and win? When you surrender, you lose. It's a paradox.
Yeah.
The moment I surrendered, I started winning. You know, and the difference is, you know, of, you know, a faith. You know, we all believe, you know, the sun comes up and goes down. You know, to test that is like you see the guy crossing the Niagara Falls on a push banner.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that, so you know he can do that. Faith is getting in the barra.
Yeah.
I get in the barra.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, let go. You know, you know, people say, you know, you can get off the lift at any time. I don't hear it so much these days, Paul. It's that you see it in the bike club. 3%ers.
Yep.
Right? So 3% of alcoholics go skid row. Only 3% go there and might get recovery when they go right down to that peak. The other 97 die on the way down. Death has got no respect for age, colour or creed. So if people say, oh, you're lucky, you're young. You're not. I was blessed. So I shouldn't be here. This is borrowed time. All I would say is, you know, give it your best shot. Don't in and out. Just stay. Just stay. Stay with it. And more will be revealed.
Jimmy, thank you so much.
Thanks for asking.
It's been a pleasure. This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul's Goldfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholford. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.